mean, that's class.
What? Steve asked. He was sitting forward, watching the road carefully. More sand and tumbleweeds were blowing across it now, and the driving had gotten tricky.
The sign. See it?
He looked. The sign, which had originally read, "Desperation's Church and Civic Organizations Welcome You," had been changed by some wit with a spray can. It now read, "Desperation's Dead Dogs Welcome You." A rope, frayed at one end, flapped back and forth in the wind. Old Shep himself was gone, however. The buzzards had gotten their licks in first. Then the coyotes had come. Hungry and not a bit shy about eating a first cousin, they had snapped the rope and dragged the shepherd's carcass away, pausing only to squabble and fight with one another. What remained, mostly bones and toenails, lay over the next rise. The blowing sand would cover it soon enough.
"Boy, folks around here must love a good laugh," Steve said.
"They must." She pointed. "Stop there." It was a rusty Quonset hut. The sign in front of it read Desperation Mining Corp. There was a parking lot beside it with 10 or 12 cars and trucks in it. He pulled over but didn't turn into the lot, at least not yet. The wind was blowing more steadily now, the gusts gradually merging into one steady blast. To the west, the sun was a surreal red-orange disk hanging over the Desitoya Mountains, as flat and bloated as a photo of the planet Jupiter. Steve could hear a fast and steady tink-tink-tink-tink coming from somewhere nearby, possibly the sound of a steel lanyard clip banging against a flagpole.
"What's on your mind?" he asked her.
"Let's call the cops from here. There's people. See the lights?" He glanced toward the Quonset and saw 5 or 6 golden squares of brightness toward the rear of the building. In the dusty gloom, they looked like lighted windows in a train car. He looked back at Cynthia and shrugged.
"Why from here, when we could just drive to the local cop shop? The middle of town, such as it is, can't be far."
She rubbed one hand across her forehead as if she were tired or getting a headache. "You said you'd be careful. I said I'd help you be careful. That's what I'm trying to do now. I sort of want to see how things are hanging before someone in a uniform sits me down in a chair and starts shooting questions. And don't ask me why, because I don't really know. If we call the cops and they sound cool, that's fine. They're cool, we're cool. But where the fuck were they? Never mind your boss, he disappeared almost clean. But an RV parked beside the road, the tires flat, door unlocked, valuables inside? I mean, give me a break. Where were the cops?"
"It goes back to that, doesn't it?"
"Yeah, back to that. The cops could have been at the scene of a road accident, or a ranch fire, or a convenience store stick-up, even a murder, and she knew it. All of them, because there just weren't that many cops out in this part of the world. But still, yeah. It came back to that, because it felt more than funny. It felt wrong."
"Okay," Steve said mildly, and turned into the parking lot. "Might not be anybody at what passes for the Desperation PD anyhow. It's getting late. I'm surprised there's still anyone here, to tell you the truth. Must be money and minerals, huh?"
He parked next to a pickup, opened the door, and the wind snatched it out of his hand. It banged the side of the truck. Steve winced, half expecting a slim Pickens type to come running toward him, holding his hat on with one hand and yelling, "Hey there, boy!" No owner did. A tumbleweed zoomed by, apparently headed for Salt Lake City, but that was all. And the alkali dust was flying, plenty of it. He had a red bandana in his back pocket. He took it out, knotted it around his neck, and pulled it up over his mouth.
"Hold it, hold it," he said, tugging her arm to keep her from opening her door just yet.
He leaned over so he could open the glove compartment. He rummaged and found another bandana, this one blue, and handed it to her.
"Put that on first."
She held it up, examined it gravely, then turned her wide little girl eyes on him again. "No cootie bugs?" He snorted and grinned behind the red bandana.
Area 1, ma'am, as we say back in Lubbock. Put it on.
She nodded it, then pulled it up. Butch and Sundance, she said, her voice a little muffled.
Yeah, Bonnie and Clyde.
Omar and Sharif, she said, and giggled.
Be careful getting out. The wind's really getting cranked up.
He stepped out, and the wind slapped him in the face, making him stagger as he reached the front of the van. Flying grit stung his forehead. Cynthia was holding on to her door handle, head down, the Peter Tosh shirt flapping out behind her skinny midriff like a sail. There was still some daylight left, and the sky overhead was still blue, but the landscape had taken on a strange, shadowless quality. It was stormlight, if Steve had ever seen it.
Come on, he yelled, and put an arm around Cynthia's waist. Let's get out of this.
They hurried across the cracked asphalt to the long building. There was a door at one end of it. The sign bolted to the corrugated metal beside it read, Desperation Mining Corp., like the one out front. But Steve saw that this one had been painted over something else, some other name that was starting to show through the white paint like a red ghost. He was pretty sure that one of the painted over words was Diablo, with the I modified into a devil's pitchfork. Cynthia was tapping the door with one bitten fingernail. A sign had been hung on the inside from one of those little transparent suction cups. Steve thought there was something perfectly, irritatingly, showily Western about the message on the sign.
If we're open, we're open. If we're closed, y'all come back. They forgot sun, he said.
Huh?
It should say, y'all come back sun. Then it would be perfect.
He glanced at his watch and saw that it was 7:20, which meant they were closed, of course. Except if they were closed, what were those cars and trucks doing in the parking lot? He tried the door. It pushed open. From inside came the sound of country music, broken by heavy static.
I build it one piece at a time, Johnny Cash sang, and it didn't cost me a dime.
They stepped in. The door closed on a pneumatic arm. Outside, the wind played rattle and hum along the ridged metal sides of the building. They were in a reception area. To the right were four chairs with patched vinyl seats. They looked like they were mostly used by beefy men wearing dirty jeans and work boots. There was a long coffee table in front of the chairs, piled with magazines you didn't find in the doctor's office. Guns and Ammo, Road and Track, MacLean's Mining Report, Metallurgy Newsletter, Arizona Highways. There was also a very old penthouse with Tonya Harding on the cover. Straight ahead of them was a field gray receptionist's desk, so dented it might have been kicked here all the way from Highway 50. It was loaded down with papers, a crazily stacked set of volumes marked MSHA Guidelines. An overloaded ashtray sat on top of these, and three wire baskets full of rocks. A manual typewriter perched on one end of the desk, no computer that Steve could see, and a chair in the knee hole, the kind that runs on casters, but nobody sitting in it. The air conditioning was running, and the room was uncomfortably cool. Steve walked around the desk, saw a cushion sitting on the chair, and picked it up so Cynthia could see it. Park Your Ass had been crocheted across the front in old-fashioned, Western-style lettering. Oh, tasteful, she said. Operators are standing by. Use 2D. On the desk, flanked by a joke sign, Lead me not into temptation, for I shall find it myself, and a name plaque, Brad Josephson, was a stiff studio photo of an overweight but pretty black woman flanked by two cute kids. A male receptionist then, and not exactly Mr. Neat. The radio, an old cracked Philco, sat on a nearby shelf, along with the phone.
Right about then my wife walked out, Johnny Cash bawled through wild cannonades of static, and I could see right away she had her doubts, but she opened the door and said, Honey, take me for a...
Steve turned off the radio. The hardest gust of wind yet hit the building, making it creak like a submarine under pressure. Cynthia, still with the bandana he'd given her, pulled up over her nose, looked around uneasily. The radio was off, but, very faintly, Steve could still hear Johnny Cash singing about how he'd smuggled his car out of the GM plant in his lunch bucket, one piece at a time. Same station, different radio, way back. Where the lights were, he guessed. Cynthia pointed to the phone. Steve picked it up, listened, dropped it back into its cradle again. Dead. Must be a line down someplace. Aren't they underground these days? She asked, and Steve noticed an interesting thing. They were both talking in low tones, really not much more than a step or two above a whisper.
I think maybe they haven't gotten around to that in desperation just yet.
There was a door behind the desk. He reached for the handle, and she grabbed his arm.
What? Steve asked.
I don't know. She let go of him, reached up, pulled her bandana down. Then she laughed nervously.
I don't know, man. This is just so wacky.
Got to be someone back there, he said. The door's unlocked, lights on, cars in the parking lot.
You're scared too, aren't you?
He thought it over and nodded. Yes, it was like before the thunderstorms, the benders, when he had been a kid, only with all the strange joy squeezed out of it. But we still ought to...
Yeah, I know. Go on.
She swallowed, and he heard something go click in her throat.
Hey, tell me we're going to be laughing at each other and feeling stupid in a few seconds. Can you do that, Lubbock?
In a few seconds, we're going to be laughing at each other and feeling stupid.
Thanks.
No problem, he said, and opened the door. A narrow hallway ran down it, 30 feet or so. There was a double run of fluorescent bars overhead, and all-weather carpet on the floor. There were 2 doors on one side, both open, and 3 on the other, 2 open and 1 shut. At the end of the corridor, bright yellow light filled up what looked to Steve like a work area of some kind. A shop, maybe, or a lab. That was where the lighted windows they'd seen from the outside were, and where the music was coming from. Johnny Cash had given way to the Tractors, who claimed that Baby liked to rock it like a boogie-woogie choo-choo train. Sounded like typical brag and bluster to Steve.
This is fucked. You know that, don't you?
He knew. There was a radio. There was the wind, loaded with sour alkali grit, now hitting the building's metal sides hard enough to sound like a Montana blizzard. But where were the voices? Men talking, joking, shooting the shit. The men who went with the vehicles parked out front. He started slowly down the corridor, thinking that he should call out something like, "Hey, anybody home?" And not quite daring to. The place felt simultaneously empty and somehow not empty, although how it could be both things at the same time was... Cynthia yanked on the back of his shirt. The tug was so hard and so sudden that he almost screamed.
"What?"
he asked, exasperated, heart pounding, and realized that now he was whispering.
"Do you hear that?" she asked. "Sounds like, I don't know, a kid bubbling Kool-Aid through a straw."
At first he could only hear the Tractors. She said her name was Emergency and asked to see my gun. She said her telephone number was 911. And then he did hear it. A fast, liquid sound. Mechanical, not human. A sound he almost knew.
"Yeah, I hear it."
"Steve, I want to get out of here."
"Go back to the truck, then."
"No."
"Cynthia, for Christ's sake."
He looked at her big eyes looking back up at him, her pursed, anxious mouth, and quit it. No, she didn't want to go back to the Ryder van by herself, and he didn't blame her. She called herself a hard-headed babe, and maybe she was, but right now she was also an almost scared-to-death babe. He took her by her thin shoulders, pulled her toward him, and planted a loud smackaroo on her forehead, right between the eyes.
"Do not worry, little Nell,"
he said in a very passable Dudley Do-Right imitation,
"for I will protect you."
She grinned in spite of herself. Fucking dork. Come on, stay close, and if we do have to run, run fast, or else I might trample you.
You don't need to worry about that, Cynthia said. I'll be out the door and gone before you even get it in gear.
The first door on the right was an office. Empty. There was a corkboard on the wall covered with Polaroid shots of an open-pit mine. That was the big wall of earth they'd seen looming behind the town, Steve assumed. The first door on the left, also an office. Also empty. The bubbling sound was louder now, and Steve knew what it was even before he looked into the next door on the right. He felt a measure of relief. It's an aquarium, he said. That's all it is. This was a much nicer office than the first two they'd peeped into, with a real rug on the floor. The aquarium was on a stand to the left of the desk, under a photograph of two men in boots, hats, and Western-style business suits shaking hands by a flagpole. The one out back, most likely. It was a well-populated aquarium. He saw tigers, angelfish, goldfish, and a couple of black beauties. There was also some strange gigaw lying on the sand at the bottom, one of the things people put into their aquariums to decorate them, he assumed. Except this one wasn't a sunken ship or a pirate chest or King Neptune's castle. This one was something else. Something that looked like...
Hey, Steve, Cynthia whispered in a strengthless little voice. That's a hand.
What? He asked, honestly not understanding, although later he would think he must have known what it was, lying there at the bottom of the aquarium. What else could it have been?
A hand, she almost moaned. A fucking hand!
And... as one of the tigers swam between the second and third fingers, the third had a slim gold wedding ring on it. He saw that she was right. There were fingernails on it. There was a thin white thread of scar on the thumb. It was a hand. He stepped forward, ignoring her grab at his shoulder, and bent down for a better look. His hope that the hand was fake, despite the wedding ring and the realistic thread of scar, glimmered away. There were shreds of flesh and sinew rising from the wrist. They wavered like plankton in the currents generated by the tank's regulator, and he could see the bones. He straightened up and saw Cynthia standing at the desk. The top of this one was much neater. There was a power book on it, closed. Next to it was a telephone. Next to the phone was an answering machine with a red message light blinking. Cynthia picked up the telephone, listened, then put it back. He was startled by the whiteness of her face. With that little blood in her head, she should be lying on the floor, dead fainted away, he thought. Instead of fainting, she reached a finger toward the play messages button on the answering machine.
Don't do that, he hissed.
God knew why, and it was too late anyway. There was a beep. A click. Then a strange voice. It seemed to be neither male nor female, and it scared the hell out of Steve, began to speak. Numa, it said in a contemplative voice. Soma. Sarx. Numa. Soma. Sarx. Numa. Soma. Sarx. It went on, slowly enunciating these words, seeming to grow louder as it spoke. Was that possible? He stared at the machine, fascinated, the words hitting into his brain. Soma. Sarx. Numa. Like tiny, sharp carpet tacks. He might have gone on staring at it for God knew how long if Cynthia hadn't reached past him and banged the stop button hard enough to make the machine jump on the desk.
Sorry, nope, too creepy. She sounded both apologetic and defiant.
They left the office. Farther down the corridor, in the workroom or lab or whatever it was, the tractors were still singing about the boogie-woogie girl who had it stacked up to the ceiling and sticking in your face.
How long is that fucking song? Steve wondered. It's been playing 15 minutes already. Got to have been.
Can we go now? Cynthia asked. Please? He pointed down the hall toward the bright yellow lights.
Oh, Jesus, you're nuts, she said. But when he started in that direction, she followed him.
5. Where are you taking me? Ellen Carver asked for the third time. She leaned forward, hooking her fingers through the mesh between the cruiser's front and back seats. Please, can't you tell me? At first, she'd just been thankful not to be raped or killed, and relieved that, when they got to the foot of the lethal stairs, poor sweet little Kirsty's body was gone. There had been a huge bloodstain on the steps outside the doors, however, still not entirely dry and only partially covered by the blowing sand which had stuck to it. She guessed it had belonged to Mary's husband. She tried to step over it, but the cop, Entragian, had her arm in a pincer's grip and simply pulled her through it so that her sneakers left 3 ugly red tracks behind as they went around the corner to the parking lot. Bad. All of it. Horrible. But she was still alive. Yes, relief at first, but that had been replaced by a growing sense of dread. For one thing, whatever was happening to this awful man was now speeding up. She could hear little liquid pops as his skin let go in various places, and trickling noises as blood flowed and dripped. The back of his uniform shirt, formerly khaki, was now a muddy red. And she didn't like the direction he had taken. South. There was nothing in that direction but the vast bulwark of the open pit mine. The cruiser rolled slowly along Main Street. She assumed it was Main Street, weren't they always? Passing a final pair of businesses, another bar, and Harvey's Small Engine Repair. The last shop on the street was a somehow sinister little shack with Bodega written above the door, and a sign out front which the wind had blown off its stand. Ellen could read it anyway. Mexican Foods. The sun was a declining ball of dusty furnace fire, and the landscape had a kind of clear daylight darkness about it that struck her as apocalyptic. It wasn't so much a question of where she was, she realized, as who she was. She couldn't believe she was the same Ellen Carver who was on the PTA and had been considering a run for school board this fall. The same Ellen Carver who sometimes went out to lunch with friends at China Happiness, where they would get all silly over Mai Tais and talk about clothes and kids and marriages, whose was shaky and whose was not. Was she the Ellen Carver who picked her nicest clothes out of the Boston Proper catalog and wore red perfume when she was feeling amorous and had a funny rhinestone T-shirt that said Queen of the Universe? The Ellen Carver who had raised 2 lovely children and had kept her man while those all about her were losing theirs? The one who examined her breasts for lumps once every 6 weeks or so? The one who liked to curl up in the living room on weekend nights with a cup of hot tea and a few chocolates and paperbacks with titles like Misery in Paradise? Really? Oh, really? Well, yes, probably. She was those Ellens and 1,000 others. Ellen in silk and Ellen in denim, and Ellen sitting on the commode and peeing with a recipe for Brown Betty in one hand. She was, she supposed, both her parts and more than her parts, when summed, could account for. But could that possibly mean she was also the Ellen Carver whose well-loved daughter had been murdered and who now sat huddled in the back of a police car that was beginning to stink unspeakably? A woman being driven past a fallen sign reading Mexican Foods. A woman who would never see her home or friends or husband again. Was she the Ellen Carver being driven into a dirty, windy darkness where no one read the Boston Proper catalog or drank Mai Tais with little paper umbrellas poking out of them and only death awaited? Oh, God, please don't kill me. She said in a boneless, trembly voice she could not recognize as her own. Please, sir, don't kill me. I don't want to die. I'll do whatever you say, but don't kill me. Please don't.
He didn't answer. There was a thump from beneath them as the tar quit. The cop pulled the knob which turned on the headlights, but they didn't seem to help much. What she saw were two bright cones shining into a world of roiling dust. Every now and then a tumbleweed would fly in front of them, headed east. Gravel rumbled beneath the tires and pinged against the undercarriage. They passed a long, ramshackle building with rusty metal sides, a factory or some kind of mill, she thought, and then the road tilted up. They started to climb the embankment.
Please,
she whispered. Please, just tell me what you want.
Ugh,
he said, grimacing, and reached into his mouth like a man who's got a hair on his tongue. Instead of a hair, he pulled out the tongue itself. He looked at it for a moment, lying limply in his fist like a piece of liver, and then tossed it aside. They passed two pickup trucks, a dump truck, and a yellow ghost backhoe, all parked together inside the first switchback the road made on its way to the top.
If you're going to kill me, make it quick, she said in her trembly voice. Please don't hurt me. Do that much at least. Promise you won't hurt me.
But the slumped, bleeding figure behind the wheel of the cruiser promised her nothing. It simply drove through the flying dust, guiding the car to the crest of the bulwark. The cop didn't hesitate at the top, but crossed the rim and started down, leaving the wind above them as he did. Ellen looked back, wanting to see some last light, but she was too late. The walls of the pit had already hidden what remained of the sunset. The cruiser was descending into a vast lake of darkness, an abyss that made a joke of the headlights. Down here, night had already fallen. Chapter 2 1 You've had a conversion, Reverend Martin once told David. This was near the beginning. It was also around the time that David began to realize that by 4 o'clock on most Sunday afternoons, Reverend Jean Martin was no longer strictly sober. It would still be some months, however, before David realized just how much his new teacher drank. In fact, yours is the only genuine conversion I've ever seen, perhaps the only genuine one I'll ever see. These are not good times for the God of our fathers, David. Lots of people talking the talk, not many walking the walk. David wasn't sure that conversion was the right word for what had happened to him, but he hadn't spent much time worrying about it. Something had happened, and just coping with it was enough. The something had brought him to Reverend Martin, and Reverend Martin, drunk or not, had told him things he needed to know and set him tasks that he needed to do. When David had asked him at one of those Sunday afternoon meetings, soundless basketball on the TV that day, what he should be doing, Reverend Martin had responded promptly, "The job of the new Christian is to meet God, to know God, to trust God, to love God. That's not like taking a list to the supermarket either, where you can dump stuff into your basket in any order you like. It's a progression, like working your way up the math ladder from counting to calculus. You've met God, and rather spectacularly, too. Now you've got to get to know him."
"Well, I talked to you," David had said.
"Yes, and you talk to God. You do, don't you? Haven't given up on the praying?"
"Nope. Don't often hear back, though."
Reverend Martin had laughed and taken a sip from his teacup. "God's a lousy conversationalist, no question about that, but he left us a user's manual. I suggest you consult it."
"Huh?"
"The Bible," Reverend Martin had said, looking at him over the rim of his cup with bloodshot eyes. So he had read the Bible, starting in March and finishing Revelation, "The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. Amen," just a week or so before they had left Ohio. He had done it like homework, 20 pages a night, weekends off, making notes, memorizing stuff that seemed important, skipping only the parts Reverend Martin told him he could skip, mostly the begats. And what he remembered most clearly now, as he stood shivering at the sink in the jail cell, dousing himself with icy water, was the story of Daniel in the lion's den. King Darius hadn't really wanted to throw Danny in there, but his advisors had mousetrapped him somehow. David had been amazed at how much of the Bible was politics. "You stop that!" his father screamed, startling David out of his thoughts and making him look around. In the growing gloom, Ralph Carver's face was long with terror, his eyes red with grief. In his agitation, he sounded like an 11-year-old himself, one having a hell of a tantrum. "Stop that right now! Do you hear me?" David turned back to the sink without answering and began to splash water on his face and in his hair. He remembered King Darius's parting advice to Daniel before Daniel was led away. "Thy God, whom thou servest in your days and nights, will deliver thee." And something else, something Daniel had said the next day about why God had shut the lions' mouths. "David! David!" But he wouldn't look again. Couldn't. He hated it when his father cried, and he had never seen or heard him cry like this. It was awful, as if someone had cut open a vein in his heart. "David, you answer me!" "Put a sock in it, pal," Marinville said. "You put a sock in it," Mary told him. "But he's getting the coyote riled." She ignored him. "David, what are you doing?" David didn't answer. This wasn't the kind of thing you could discuss rationally, even if there was time, because faith wasn't rational. This was something Reverend Martin had told him over and over again, drilling him with it, like some important spelling rule, I before E, except after C. Sane men and women don't believe in God. That was all. That was flat. You can't say it from the pulpit because the congregation had run you out of town, but it's the truth. God isn't about reason. God is about faith and belief. God says, sure, take away the safety net. And when that's gone, take away the tightrope, too. He filled his hands with water once more and splashed it over his face and into his hair. His head. That would be where he succeeded or failed. He knew that already. It was the biggest part of him, and he didn't think there was much give to a person's skull. David grabbed the bar of Irish Spring and began to lather himself with it. He didn't bother with his legs, there would be no problem there, but worked from the groin on up, rubbing harder and generating more suds as he went. His father was still yelling at him, but now there was no time to listen. The thing was, he had to be quick, and not just because he was apt to lose his nerve if he stopped too long to think about the coyote sitting out there. If he let the soap dry, it wouldn't serve to grease him. It would gum him up and hold him back instead. He gave his neck a fast lube job, then did his face and hair. Eyes slitted, soap still clutched in one hand, he padded to the cell door. A horizontal bar crossed the vertical ones about 3 feet off the floor. The gap between the vertical bars was at least 4 inches and maybe 5. The cells in the holding area had been built to hold men, brawny miners for the most part, not skinny 11-year-old boys, and he didn't expect much trouble slipping through, at least until he got to his head. Quick, hurry, don't think, trust God. He knelt, shivering and covered with green soap slime from the hips on up, and began rubbing the cake of soap up and down. First on the inside of one white-painted vertical bar, then on the other. Out by the desk, the coyote got to its feet. Its growl rose to a snarl. Its yellow eyes were fixed intently on David Carver. Its muzzle wrinkled back in an unpleasantly toothy grin. "David, no! Don't do it, son! Don't be crazy!" "He's right, kid." Marinville was standing at the bars of his cell now, hands wrapped around them. So was Mary. That was embarrassing, but probably natural enough, considering the way his father was carrying on. And it couldn't be helped. He had to go, and go now. He hadn't been able to draw any hot water from the tap, and he thought the cold would dry the soap on his skin even quicker. He recalled the story of Daniel and the lions again as he dropped to one knee, gathering himself. Not very surprising, given the circumstances. When King Darius arrived the next day, Daniel had been fine. "My God hath sent his anger, and hath shut the lions' mouths," Daniel told him, "forasmuch as innocency was found in me." That wasn't exactly right, but David knew the word innocency was. It had fascinated him, chimed somewhere deep inside him. Now he spoke it to the being whose voice he sometimes heard, the one he identified as the voice of the other. "Find innocency in me, God. Find innocency in me, and shut that fleabag's mouth. Jesus' name I pray. Amen." He turned sideways, then propped his whole weight on one arm, like Jack Palance doing push-ups at the Academy Awards. In this fashion, he was able to stick both feet out through the bars at the same time. He wriggled backward, now out to his ankles, now his knees, now his thighs, which was where he first felt the painted bars press their soap-slick coolness against him. "No!" Mary screamed. "No! Get away from him, you ugly fuck! Get away from him!" There was a clink. It was followed by a thin, rolling marble sound. David turned his head long enough to see Mary with her hands now outside the bars of her cell. The left was cupped. He saw her pick another coin out of it with her right hand and throw it at the coyote. This time it barely paid attention, although the quarter struck it on the flank. The animal started toward David's bare feet and legs instead, head lowered, snarling. 2. "Oh, Christ Almighty," Johnny thought. "Goddamn kid must have checked his brains at the door." Then he yanked the belt out of the bottom of his motorcycle jacket, stuck his arm as far out through the bars as he could, and brought the buckle end down on the coyote's scant flank, just as it was about to help itself to the kid's right foot. The coyote yelped in pain as well as surprise this time. It whirled, snatching at the belt. Johnny yanked it away. It was too thin, too apt to give out in the coyote's jaws before the kid could get out. If the kid actually could get out, which Johnny doubted. He let the belt go flying over his shoulder and yanked off the heavy leather jacket itself, trying to hold the coyote's yellow gaze as he did so, willing it not to look away. The animal's eyes reminded him of the cop's eyes. The kid shoved his butt through the bars with a gasp, and Johnny had time to wonder how that felt on the old family jewels. The coyote started to turn toward the sound, and Johnny flung the leather jacket out at it, holding on by the collar. If the animal hadn't taken two steps forward to snatch at the belt, the jacket wouldn't have reached it. But the coyote had, and the jacket did. When it brushed the animal's shoulder, it whirled and seized the jacket so fiercely that it was almost snapped out of Johnny's hands. As it was, he was dragged headfirst into the bars. It hurt like a mother, and a bright red rocket went off behind his eyes, but he still had time to be grateful that his nose had gone between the bars rather than into one. "No, you don't," he grunted, winding his hands into the leather collar and pulling. "Come on, hon. Come on over, you nasty gopher-eating bugger. Come on over and say howdy." The coyote snarled bitterly at him, the sound muffled through its mouthful of jacket. $1,200 at Barney's in New York. Johnny had never quite pictured it like this when he had tried it on. He bunched his arms, not as powerful as they had been 30 years ago, but not puny either, and dragged the coyote forward. Its claws slid on the hardwood floor. It got one front leg braced against the desk and shook the jacket from side to side, trying to yank it out of Johnny's hands. His collection of lifesavers went flying, his maps, his spare set of keys, his pocket pharmacy, aspirin, codeine caps, sucrets, a tube of Preparation H, his sunglasses, and his goddamn cellular phone. He let the coyote take a step or two backward, trying to keep it interested, to play it like a fish, then yanked it forward again. It bonked its head on the corner of the desk this time, a sound that warmed Johnny's heart. "Arriba!" he grunted. "How'd that feel, honey?" "Hurry up!" Mary screamed. "Hurry up, David!" Johnny glanced over at the kid's cell. What he saw made his muscles relax with fear. When the coyote yanked on the jacket this time, the animal came very close to pulling it free. "Hurry up!" the woman screamed again. But Johnny saw that the kid couldn't hurry up. Soaped up, naked as a peeled shrimp, he had gotten as far as his chin, and there he was stuck, with the whole length of his body out in the holding area, and his head back inside the cell. Johnny had one overwhelming impression, mostly called to mind by the twist of the neck and the stressed line of the jaw. The kid was hung. 3. He did okay until he got to his head, and there he stuck fast with his cheek on the boards and the shelf of his jaw pressed against one soapy bar and the back of his head against the other. A panic driven by claustrophobia, the smell of the wood floor, the iron touch of the bars, a nightmare memory of a picture he'd once seen of a Puritan in stocks, dimmed his vision like a dark curtain. He could hear his dad shouting, the woman screaming, and the coyote snarling, but those sounds were all far away. His head was stuck. He'd have to go back. Only he wasn't sure he could go back, because now his arms were out, and one was pinned under him, and... "God help me," he thought. It didn't seem like a prayer. It was maybe too scared and up against it to be a prayer. "Please help me. Don't let me be stuck. Please help me." "Turn your head," the voice he sometimes heard now told him. As always, it spoke in an almost disinterested way, as if the things it was saying should have been self-evident, and as always, David recognized it by the way it seemed to pass through him, rather than to come from him. An image came to him then, hands pressing the front and back of a book, squeezing the pages together a little in spite of the boards and the binding. Could his head do that? David thought, or perhaps only hoped, that it could. But he would have to be in the right position. "Turn your head," the voice had said. From somewhere behind him came a thick, ripping sound, then Marinville's voice, somehow amused, scared, and outraged all at the same time. "Do you know how much that thing cost?" David twisted around so he lay on his back instead of his side. Just having the pressure of the bar off his jaw was an incredible relief. Then he reached up and placed his palms against the bars. "Is this right?" No answer. So often there was no answer. Why was that? "Because God is cruel," the Reverend Martin, who kept school inside his head, replied. "God is cruel. I have popcorn, David. Why don't I make some? Maybe we can find one of those old horror movies on TV, something universal, maybe even The Mummy." He pushed with his hands. At first nothing happened, but then, slowly, slowly, his soapy head began sliding between the bars. There was one terrible moment when he stopped with his ears crushed against the sides of his head and the pressure beating on his temples, a sick throb that was maybe the worst physical hurt he had ever known. In that moment he was sure he was going to stick right where he was and die in agony, like a heretic caught in some inquisitorial torture device. He shoved harder with his palms, eyes looking up at the dusty ceiling with agonized concentration, and gave a small, relieved moan as he began to move again almost at once. With the narrowest aspect of his skull presented to the bars, he was able to deliver himself into the holding area without too much more trouble. One of his ears was trickling blood, but he was out. He had made it. Naked, covered with foamy greenish curds of Irish spring soap, David sat up. A monstrous bolt of pain shot through his head from back to front, and for a moment he felt his eyes were literally bugging out, like those of a cartoon Romeo who has just spotted a dishy blonde. The coyote was the least of his problems, at least for the time being. God had shut its mouth with a motorcycle jacket. Stuff from the pockets was scattered everywhere, and the jacket itself was torn straight down the middle. A limp rag of saliva-coated black leather hung from the side of the coyote's muzzle like a well-chewed cheroot. "Get out, David!" his father cried. His voice was hoarse with tears and anxiety. "Get out while you still can!" The gray-haired man, Marinville, flicked his eyes up to David momentarily. "He's right, kid. Get lost." He looked back down at the snarling coyote. "Come on, Rover, you can do better than that. By Jesus, I'd like to be around when you start shitting zippers by the light of the moon." He yanked the jacket hard. The coyote came skidding along the floor, head down, neck stretched, forelegs stiff, shaking its narrow head from side to side as it tried to pull the jacket away from Marinville. David turned on his knees and pulled his clothes out through the bars. He squeezed his pants, feeling for the tube of the shotgun shell in the pocket. The shotgun shell was there. He got to his feet, and for a few seconds the world turned into a merry-go-round. He had to reach out for the bars of his erstwhile cell to keep from falling over. Billingsley put a hand over his. It was surprisingly warm. "Go, son," he said. "Time's almost up." David turned and tottered toward the door. His head was still throbbing, and his balance was badly off. The door seemed to be on a rocker or a spindle or something. He staggered, regained his footing, and opened the door. He turned to look at his father. "I'll be back." "Don't you dare," his father said at once. "Find a phone and call the cops, David. The state cops. And be careful. Don't let..." There was a harsh, ripping sound as Johnny's expensive leather jacket finally tore in two. The coyote, not expecting such a sudden victory, went flying backward, rolled over on its side, and saw the naked boy in the doorway. It scrambled to its feet and flew at him with a snarl. Mary screamed. "Go, kid! Get out!" Johnny yelled. David ducked out and yanked the door shut behind him. A split second later, the coyote hit it with a thud. A howl, terrible because it was so close, rose from the holding area. It was as if it knew it had been fooled, David thought. As if it also knew that, when the man who had summoned it here returned, he would not be pleased. There was another thud as the coyote threw itself at the door again. A pause, then a third. The animal howled again. Goose flesh rose on David's soapy arms and chest. Just ahead of him were the stairs down which his kid sister had tumbled to her death. If the crazy cop hadn't moved her, she would still be at the bottom, waiting for him in the gloom, eyes open and accusing, asking him why he hadn't stopped Mr. Big Boogeyman. What good was a big brother if he couldn't stop the boogeyman? "I can't go down there," he thought. "I can't. I absolutely can't." No, but all the same, he had to. Outside, the wind gusted hard enough to make the brick building creak like a ship in a working sea. David could hear dust, too, hitting the side of the building and the street doors down there like fine snow. The coyote howled again, separated from him only by an inch or so of wood, and knowing it. David closed his eyes and pressed his fingers together in front of his mouth and chin. "God, this is David Carver again. I'm in such a mess, God, such a mess. Please protect me and help me do what I have to do. Jesus' name I pray, amen." He opened his eyes, took a deep breath, and groped for the stair railing. Then, naked, holding his clothes against his chest with his free hand, David Carver started down into the shadows. 4. Steve tried to speak and couldn't. Tried again and still couldn't, although this time he did manage a single dry squeak. "You sound like a mouse farting behind a baseboard," he thought. He was aware that Cynthia was squeezing his hand in a grip powerful enough to be painful, but the pain didn't seem to matter. He didn't know how long they would have stood there in the doorway of the big room at the end of the Quonset hut if the wind hadn't blown something over outside and sent it clattering down the street. Cynthia gasped, like someone who has been punched, and put the hand not holding Steve's up to one side of her face. She turned to look at him that way, so he could see only one wide, horrified eye. Tears were trickling down from it. "Why?" she whispered. "Why?" He shook his head. He didn't know why, didn't have a clue. The only two things he was sure of were that the people who had done this were already gone, or he and Cynthia would have been dead already, and that he, Stephen Ames of Lubbock, Texas, did not want to be here if they decided to come back. The large space at the end of the Quonset hut looked like a combination workroom, lab, and storage area. It was lit by hanging high-intensity lamps with metal hoods, a little like the lights which hang over the tables in billiard emporiums. They cast a bright, lemony glow. It looked to Steve as if two crews might have worked here at the same time, one doing assay work on the left side of the room, the other sorting and cataloging on the right. There were Dan Duck's laundry baskets lined up against the wall on the sorting side, each with chunks of rock in it. These had clearly been sorted. One basket was filled with rocks that were mostly black, another with smaller rocks, almost pebbles, that were shot through with glitters of quartz. On the assay side, if that was what it was, there was a line of Macintosh computers set up on a long table, littered with tools and manuals. The Macs were running screensaver programs. One featured pretty, multicolored helix shapes above the words, "Gas Chromatograph Ready." Another, surely not Disney-sanctioned, showed Goofy pulling down his pants every 7 seconds or so, revealing a large boner with the words, "Hyuk, hyuk, hyuk," written on it. At the far end of the room, inside a closed overhead garage door with the words, "Welcome to Hernando's Hideaway," printed on it in blue paint, was an ATV with an open carrier hooked up behind it. This was also full of rock samples. On the wall to its left was a sign reading, "You must wear a hard hat. MSHA regulations. No excuses." There was a row of hooks running below the sign, but there were no hard hats hung from them. The hard hats were scattered on the floor, below the dangling feet of the people who had been hung from the hooks, hung like roasts in a butcher's walk-in freezer. "Steve? Steve, are they like dummies? Department store mannequins? Is it, you know, a joke?" "No." The word was small and felt as dusty as the air outside, but it was a start. "You know they're not. Let up, Cynthia. You're breaking my hand." "Don't make me let go," she said in a wavery voice. Her hand was still up to her face, and she stared one-eyed at the dangling corpses across the room. On the radio, the tractors had been replaced by David Lee Murphy, and David Lee Murphy had given way to an ad for a place called Whalen's, which the announcer described as "Austin's Anything Store." "You don't have to let go, just let up a little," Steve said. He raised an unsteady finger and began to count. 1, 2, 3. "I think I wet my pants a little," she said. "Don't blame you." 4, 5, 6. "We have to get out of here, Steve. This makes the guy who broke my nose look like Santa Claus." Be quiet and let me count.
She fell silent, her mouth trembling and her chest hitching as she tried to contain her sobs. Steve was sorry he'd shouted. This one had been through a lot even before today, but he wasn't thinking very well.
Christ, he wasn't entirely sure he was thinking at all. 13, he said.
14, she corrected in a shaky, humble voice. Do you see? In the corner? One of them fell off. One of them fell off the...
Hook was what she was trying to say, but the stutter turned into miserable little cries, and she began to weep.
Steve took her in his arms and held her, feeling her hot, wet face throb against his chest, low on his chest. She was so goddamn small. Over the fuzz of her extravagantly colored hair, he could see the other side of the room, and she was right. There was another body crumpled in the corner. 14 dead in all, at least 3 of them women. With their heads hanging and their chins on their chests, it was hard to tell for sure about some of the others. 9 were wearing lab coats. No, 10, counting the one in the corner. And 2 were in jeans and open-necked shirts. 2 others were wearing suits, string ties, dress boots. One of these appeared to have no left hand, and Steve had a pretty good idea of where that hand might be. Oh, yes, indeed he did. Most had been shot, and they must have been facing their killers because Steve could see gaping exit wounds in the backs of most of the dropped heads. At least 3, however, had been open like fish. They hung with their white coats stained maroon and pools of blood beneath them and their guts dangling. Now, here's Mary Chapin Carpenter to tell us why she feels lucky today, the radio announcer said, emerging gamely from another blast of static. Maybe she's been to Wayland's in Austin. Let's find out. Mary Chapin Carpenter began to tell the hanging dead men and women in the lab of the Desperation Mining Corporation about her lucky day, how she'd won the lottery and all, and Steve let go of Cynthia. He took a step into the lab and sniffed the air. No gun smoke that he could smell, and maybe that didn't mean much. The air conditioners probably turned over the air in here pretty fast. But the blood was dry on the corpses which had been eviscerated, and that probably meant whoever had done this was long gone.
"Let's go," Cynthia hissed, tugging his arm.
"Okay," he said, "just..."
He broke off as something caught his eye. It was sitting on the end of the computer table, to the right of the screen with the goofy flasher on it. Not a rock, or not just a rock, anyway. Some kind of stone artifact. He walked over and looked at it. The girl scurried after him and yanked his arm again.
"What's the matter with you? This isn't a guided tour. What if..."
Then she saw what he was looking at, really saw it, and broke off. She reached out a tentative finger and touched it. She gasped and drew her finger back. At the same moment, her hips jerked forward as if she'd gotten an electric shock, and her pelvis banged into the edge of the table.
"Holy shit," she breathed. "I think I just..." And there she stopped.
"Just what?"
"Nothing." But she looked as if she was blushing, so Steve guessed maybe it was something at that. There ought to be a picture of that thing next to ugly in the dictionary. It was a rendering of what might have been a wolf or a coyote, and although it was crude, it had enough power to make them both forget, at least for a few seconds, that they were standing 60 feet from the leftovers of a mass murder. The beast's head was twisted at a strange angle, a somehow hungry angle, and its eyeballs appeared to be starting out of their sockets in utter fury. Its snout was wildly out of proportion to its body, almost the snout of an alligator, and it was split open to show a jagged array of teeth. The statue, if that was what it was, had been broken off just below the chest. There were stumps of forelegs, but that was all. The stone was pitted and eroded with age. It was glittery in places, too, like the rocks collected in one of the Danduk's baskets. Beside it, anchored by a plastic box of pushpins, was a note. "Jim,
What the hell is this? Any idea?
Barbie.
Look at its tongue, Cynthia said in a strange, dreaming voice.
What about it?
It's a snake.
Yes, he saw, it was. A rattler, maybe. Something with fangs, anyway.
Cynthia's head snapped up. Her eyes were wide.